welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. Today I'm pleased to have back as my guest Stanton Friedman, who we're discussing his book today, Flying Saucers and Science. A scientist investigates the mysteries of UFOs. Stanton was on with us in August, where we discussed his book, Science Was Wrong, which is a fascinating book that outlines areas where science took us down the wrong path. And today we're going to talk in more detail about science and flying saucers, the UFO question, and the possibility that there has been a massive cover-up, as Stanton calls it, a cosmic Watergate, and whether or not now is the time to uncover this and get things straight with the people of the entire planet knowing exactly what's happened in the past. I have a particular interest in this in that I was a major at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, which I learned later from UFO files was where they took most of, I think probably all of the alien craft and alien bodies, dead or alive, that were found since Roswell. And I kept running into people there that, some of whom were high-ranking officers, that told me they had seen the live and or dead alien bodies. And since they didn't know each other and they had no reason to lie to me, I sort of took this as evidence that perhaps something was going on at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base that was not publicly being announced. Stanton, thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. I should add to what you just said. I signed books once at a bookstore in Dayton, Ohio, right next to Wright-Patterson. And at least seven different people very quietly said when they worked out at the base, they heard that there were bodies there. These
right.
were completely independent people, and, you know, they weren't looking for anything. There was nothing to gain, and they weren't trying to make
right.
write a book
yeah.
or whatever. But after the first few, you know, you can't say, well, all these people are lying to you.
They're conspiring together
the CIA, you know?
to lead you astray. That's great. I'm sorry?
No, I was going to say that I'm sure some of the wreckage went other places, at least from Roswell.
Right.
Some pieces would have gone to Los Alamos, for example, which was nearby
right.
and had incredibly good labs because of the development of the nuclear weapons. And so who are you going to go to? Well, you got the guy down the street there who has got an appropriate high-level security clearance and all kinds of confidence. And maybe you don't tell them where the stuff came from, but you say,
right.
what is this stuff? You know, and you proceed from there when you get some very strange stuff. So, and I mention this because a couple of people have said to me, Stan, look, if Roswell had happened, they'd have had to take half the physicists away from universities at the time. And I said, nonsense. We had large, very competent labs with appropriate security clearances at Oak Ridge, at Sandia, the nuclear weapons lab, Livermore, Los Alamos, Hanford Works, and then a lot of private companies. So there seems to be this crazy notion that the only place any research gets done is academia.
That's
well,
not
you
true
want
at
a stealth
all.
Fighter, you go to Lockheed and you spend $9 billion, and 10 years later you got a stealth airplane, you know.
Right, right.
So,
well, you're set apart from a lot of the other people in this field because you've actually worked under top secret security clearances. I did not have your security clearance. I had a security clearance, but not one like you had when you worked with nuclear
GM and
topics.
Places like that. Yeah.
Right. So you know how it all works, and like you say. There's not a lot of, there's not a lot of knowledge in the general public that would allow them to understand how this sort of thing could be kept secret for as long as it has been.
Yeah, that's right. And I get people telling me, oh, that classified stuff is all declassified after 25 years. Sorry, I've been to 20 document archives. There's loads of old stuff that hasn't been declassified. And also, it's funny, people think if you've got a top secret clearance, that gives you access to everything that's top secret. No, it doesn't.
No.
You have to have a need to know. And,
right.
For example, when I was working on radiation shielding for nuclear airplanes, I wanted to get some of the radiation shielding research done by the nuclear Navy. I had the right clearance, mm-hmm. but Admiral Rickover wouldn't give me a need to know for it.
Right.
Didn't want to let
that's
the technology
true.
Out of his shop, you know. So
yeah,
that's how things work.
Compartmentalization, right, compartmentalization is
yes.
really how things are kept secret. You need to know the mechanism yes. of what compartmentalization is.
Incidentally, I made a lot of visits to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base back in the early 60s. I was project engineer on a contract. Analysis and evaluation of fast and intermediate reactors for space vehicle applications.
My
but
goodness.
One key word was left out of that title, Soviet. I was looking at
uh-huh.
Soviet research to decide how they stacked up when it came to possibly building nuclear power plants for space applications. And I correctly, I don't even have a copy of my final report. I predicted that they would be doing it because all the research that I saw was exactly the kind of stuff you'd have to do. And I was
mm-hmm.
probably the only guy in the country that was happy when Cosmos 954 came down in northern Canada. It was the 13th nuclear reactor that they tested in space. We had one. So,
mm-hmm.
but, you know,
they were ahead
even
of
the title
that
of the project, in other words, was misleading. But
right.
I did have dealings
right.
with Wright-Patt, and I am not saying that I had bad things to say about Wright-Patterson. The Foreign Technology Division, the people I worked with were sharp, good people.
Yeah, I felt that the engineers there were top-notch as well.
Yeah.
You know, I obviously didn't know how they were doing in their work, but as my interactions with them, they were bright. And, you know, there are a lot of interesting ideas about what we do with this information. I mean, I don't really know what was done with the bodies, but I have read, and as I'm sure you know a little bit about, the idea of reverse engineering with the with some of the. You want to talk a little bit about what reverse engineering is and why the government may have engaged in that?
It's not a new idea. During World War II, if a German plane crashed in England, for example, and it didn't explode, it'd run out of fuel and so forth, they'd get guys in to examine the wreckage to find
right.
out, what material they use for this purpose, what kind of tolerances on the material. They'd make loads of measurements to try to understand and to maybe get a new clue. Hey, you know, that's mm-hmm. an interesting way of doing that. Maybe we should try that. And the Germans did the same. If a British or American plane crashed in France or Germany, they could get guys there soon enough. They would try to do the same thing, standard practice. And in a kind of extended way of doing this, after the war, the Air Technology Division at Wright-Patterson, Air Materiel Command is what it was called, actually,
mm-hmm.
they sent guys to Europe who brought back tons, and I mean that literally, of paper, of German experiments on aerodynamics, on aeronautics, and all that sort of stuff, had them translated. And I saw one estimate that said that they saved us $50 million on research we didn't have to do to take advantage of what they had done. So
yeah, they'd done
when it
research,
comes to flying saucers, one of the many ways you'd want to get information would mm-hmm. be to examine wreckage. And it, for several different reasons. For example, you send out little pieces to labs that have appropriate clearance, and they knew where all the smart guys were because of all the work done on the atom bomb, you know, guys with clearances
mm-hmm.
and so forth and competence. And you'd say, what is this stuff? You don't tell them where it came from. They don't have a need to know for that. And it comes
right.
back to you said, you know, I don't know where you got this stuff, but that's a combination of samarium and cobalt. Why in the world would anybody put those together? Not your problem.
Right.
You send it out to other people, and you say, what are the electrical, mechanical, electromagnetic properties, nuclear properties of this stuff? And the guy says, you know, I don't know where you got this, but it's got the highest magnetic moment of any material I've ever tested. Make great permanent mm-hmm. magnets. Long
right.
story short, that's what we wound up using in the new speakers, you know, for the portable the radio materials and stuff. And...
Mm-hmm.
I was reading an article. I used to do a weekly science commentary for CBC Radio here in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, and CBC's Canadian Broadcasting Company. And it was an article about a new and better permanent magnet material. And it said the early work on samarium cobalt was done at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Wright Air Development Center. And I just laughed my head off. Well, then I know where that idea came
from.
Yeah,
really.
You know, it doesn't tell you how to build a saucer, but it tells you something new that you can learn from studying somebody else's technology. And that's standard practice in the military R&D classified world. And let me give you another strange example. In my book, Flying Saucers and Science, there's a picture of me and the Apollo 12 command module. I've got my hand on it. Here's this round, blunt body. And when I grew up, I thought high-speed aircraft in the atmosphere, flying in the atmosphere, had to be pointy nose, sharp wing, highly streamlined, you know, like the X-15 or something. And yet, here are command modules coming back at 25,000 miles an hour, which is pretty darn fast. And they were round, blunt bodies. But turns out at Wright Pat, they ran some wind tunnel tests on discs. Somebody might have said, hey, does this thing work? I mean, will round vehicles be okay? And somebody, oh, let's test. Aha! Look what we found out. Now, you know, it doesn't give you the whole story, but it gives you a new direction to go where you might produce something quite exciting and different. So reverse engineering is standard policy. And incidentally, it's not only when you got wreckage, like from Roswell or Aztec or other places. I mean, that's straightforward. You send it out to the right labs and you try to find out as much as you can. But you also have access to the highly classified material obtained by the fancy radar systems on board our best aircraft, by the Air Defense Command radar systems, by sometimes spy satellites. One case, the RB-47 case, involved six highly trained crewmen on board a reconnaissance bomber making measurements as this darn UFO flew around their airplane going at 450 miles an hour. And so somebody's paying attention. You know, what color was it when it, what color did the plasma around it change to, you know, when it made a right angle turn, stuff like that. So back engineering is not just handling of wreckage, but it's examining data and try to understand how could they do that. It's nice when you have something to start with, you know.
Right. And from my understanding, and I love it when you say in your book that you really can't get anywhere thinking the same things that have always been thought. You know, at the Truth Convention, it became clear as I listened to person after person presenting the data on this, that the probable way in which UFOs were coming in and out of our Earth sphere was more interdimensional than simply a straight line of flight to whatever star system they were from.
They certainly didn't have a better jet engine on them. But I should add now, I think we have to allow for two different systems, one from the vehicle that comes from another star system to here.
Right.
Interstellar space, pretty empty, you know, not much in the way of gravitational field and no atmosphere. You don't need to worry about heating and all that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then once you get in the atmosphere, going the speed of light doesn't do you much good. It only takes a seventh of a second to go around the planet. I mean, how do you meet somebody for dinner at that speed, you know?
Right.
So I think we've got two different systems, but you did hit the key fact, and that is one of my mantras. Technological progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. The future is not an extrapolation of the past. In other words, a laser isn't just a better light bulb. The nuclear rocket engines I worked on aren't just better chemical rockets. Entirely different physics and potential and capability and all that sort of stuff. So the guys who are at the top of the heap here were sharp guys. If you look at the list of members of Majestic 12, and there's an update chapter in Flying Saucers and Physics, these were guys, experienced professional people who were very busy during World War II, and several of them in command mode, if you will, generals and admirals and CIA directors and people like that. And they certainly were ready to look for different methods of doing what we normally did. And, you know, an example that I give that shocks people, that's why I give it, is that we ourselves have nuclear-powered aircraft carriers that can operate for 18 years without refueling.
Right.
You cannot do that with a conventional engine. You just burn gas or diesel fuel or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to go for 18 years without refueling, you go nuclear. You don't go chemical.
Right. Well, let's talk a little bit about the top secret Majestic 12 documents. I've found them fascinating. I read through them as part of getting ready for this interview. It seems to me that you know, there's been a lot of false documents put forward trying to convince everybody that the entire thing is false. And then we
hope it rubs off on them.
We even have one member, Dr. Donald Mintzel, who may actually be a very talented double agent. And you can go into that in more detail. It's very, very typical of what you would expect from a secret operation.
Yeah, Dr. Mintzel was, as far as I knew and everybody else knew, a total UFO debunker. He wrote four books. He was a Harvard professor of astronomy. And, okay, here he is listed as a member of Operation Majestic 12. Everybody else we know had a high-level security clearance because of the jobs they held during the war, generals and admirals and so forth. And how could a total debunker be part of a team that knew about a crash saucer at Roswell and bodies and so forth? And I had one run-in with him. I was speaking to an engineering alumni group at Harvard, and I had some time early in the day, so I called Dr. Mintzel. I gave him my name, and he says, "Oh, I know all about you," which shook me up a little bit. What did he know about me? I said, "Oh, you saw my congressional testimony next to yours." "No, I've seen letters and memos." I still don't know what he meant about those.
Well, you're obviously a topic of discussion in the top secret world.
And he said, "You can't be a scientist and believe in flying saucers," at which I laughed. He didn't like my laughing. He started to rave. Mm-hmm. I said, "Look, Dr. Mintzel, I called out of courtesy because I didn't know whether this group had put out any invitations outside their own membership. And I didn't come call you to debate. I wanted to personally invite you to the meeting tonight at 8 o'clock, wherever it was." "Oh, well, of course I won't be there." So I told the story that night, incidentally, so they know I wasn't afraid of Dr. Mintzel. But so I didn't like him. His explanations in his books could be torn to pieces by a college sophomore who knew a little physics.
Mm-hmm.
So here comes this document that says he was a member of this top-secret magic Majestic 12 group.
Mm-hmm.
And all the other names made sense, but Mintzel? So I decided to pursue it further. I can't let this go. All these guys were dead, the last one having died just 2 months before we got the document, which is very suggestive, you know, no matter which way you look at things. And so
they're not talking.
Well, they're for sure not talking. And I contacted the Harvard archives, and they had Mintzel's papers, and I'd seen some of them at the American Philosophical Society Library in Philadelphia. A lot of correspondence about UFOs, but certainly nothing that indicated he was a member of some fancy group. But in order to look at his papers at Harvard, I had to get permission from three different people, written permission, including his wife, because one of the items was an unpublished autobiography. So I did all that, and the chairman of the department and somebody else. And the Fund for UFO Research gave me a grant to go down there. I live in Fredericton, New Brunswick, which is 500 miles from there, something like that. So I drove on down, and I go to the archive, and there's nothing that talks about flying saucers. There's a list of stuff. So I found something that said John Kennedy. I'm wondering, what's that doing here? So I went to that first, fortunately, as it happens. Now, he knew President Kennedy before he was president. Kennedy was on the board of directors, board of overseers at Harvard, and astronomy was his area of interest, so he worked with Don, and as I found out from Menzel's wife, Dr. Menzel really appreciated John Kennedy, and he didn't have Don write his report. He wrote his own report. Anyway, I'm looking through this stuff, and there's a letter from Menzel to Kennedy saying, there's one area where I may be able to help you. This is during the 1960 election campaign.
Mm-hmm.
I've had a longer continuous association with the National Security Agency and its Navy predecessor, more than 30 years, than anybody else in the country. Now, that perked up my ears. NSA, mm-hmm. they're the guys who listen in on communications everywhere, you know. NSA means no such agency, or never says anything, as opposed to
mm-hmm.
National Security Agency. Anyway, that really perked me up. And then as I started reading more and more, I found out he was a code breaker. He taught code breaking. He did all kinds of classified work for all kinds of agencies long after the war was over.
He was probably pretty good at it.
Total shock. He was head of the National Naval Reserve Unit in Cambridge, Mass.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody knew he'd been in the Navy during the war, but this is long, many years after that. And he worked with the CIA and with the FBI. And
right.
I just found an overwhelming amount of stuff, which really shocked me because I wasn't expecting it. But researcher, you got to take what you get and make something out of it, you know.
Well,
so
I
eventually wound up talking to people he worked with. I talked to his wife. I talked to his daughter and found a lot more stuff clearly indicating that he belonged in a highly classified group. And it turned out he'd learned Japanese to help in the code work, and so he'd be a great guy to show the strange symbols from Roswell, you know, because that was his ball game. That was his bag. He was into code.
So how did the Operation Majestic 12 documents get released?
Well, released is should be put in quotes. They were received in the form
received.
Of a roll of film that went to Jamie Chandray in California. I'd been working with Jamie and with William Moore on Roswell.
Mm-hmm.
And out of the blue, a roll of film comes to Bill. He processes a 35-millimeter film. I hope people listening remember when we used to use film in cameras,
right.
you know. And he had developed plenty of film. He had a developing situation. And on it are 8 pages of top-secret magic material. Which briefing, the primary document, was a briefing for President-elect Eisenhower, dated 18 November 1952. That was 2 weeks after the election, incidentally, in which Eisenhower got elected. And this was a briefing for him, a preliminary briefing. And you know, there it is on the film, and you look at the prints, and you know, are these documents real? Well, we don't know. We got to look at content.
Mm-hmm.
This is film now, so you don't really have paper to test.
So this was
typeface and stuff like that. What?
Yeah. This was leaked. I mean, it wasn't gotten through Freedom of Information or anything like that.
No. No official anything. And it also didn't have, this bothered some people, didn't have a top secret control number on it.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a bunch of people saying, oh, Stan, don't you know that all top-secret documents have to have top-secret control numbers? Well, as a matter of fact, I'd already published a couple that I got from archives, so I knew that wasn't true. But I checked with archivists mm-hmm. at the Eisenhower Library and the Marshall Archives. Both of them very strongly said, no, we have plenty of top-secret material that doesn't have control numbers on it. And the example, so people understand this, if General A wants to send a memo to General B, he doesn't want to go through all kinds of paperwork. He puts it in the classified bag, and it gets on its merry way. There's no other copies, just him and the guy on the other end. However, if you're publishing a 20-page report that goes to 20 people, then you have to put control numbers on it because
you have to control it.
Yeah, I mean, you have to know who's got this stuff, so at the end of the year they can check their files and prove to you that they have it, you know. So we've got the documents, and there have been more kinds of totally nonsensical claims against these documents than you can believe. Now, one of them was profitable for me. Mr. Philip J. Klass, was the senior avionics editor at Aviation Week and Space Technology in Washington, and he wrote four anti-UFO books. He was Mr. Debunker personified. He and I've debated and gone at each other. Anyway, he sends me a note saying, perhaps you didn't notice that the typeface on one of the items was the large Pica type. But the National Security Council, which is mentioned in this particular one-page document, only used elite type, he says. Here are nine copies to prove that. Well, it turns out he got them by mail from the Eisenhower Library. He'd never been there. Mm-hmm. And I challenge you, he says, to provide any other genuine memos, letters, documents done in the same size and style type. And to encourage you to respond more quickly, I offer you $100 each for every genuine such item. And he's got a bunch of criteria. It's got to be signed and other things. And so he'd never been to the Eisenhower Library. I go to my files. I've spent weeks there. And I've got other documents from there done in the same size type. So I sent him two. I was baiting him, really. He agreed that they probably read. I was going to the Eisenhower Library, so I knew I'd have a chance to look. And it's easy to spot the large typeface. For people listening, this was all typewriters. This was not computerized. You know?
Right.
And so I go there, and I pull 14 documents that meet all his criteria, send him copies and an invoice. He set a limit up to a maximum of 10, unfortunately, because if he hadn't set a limit, I'd have made a lot of money. But anyway, he sent me the $1,000. He told everybody about challenging me and nobody about paying me. Now, the crazy part is the Eisenhower Library has 250,000 pages of National Security Council materials. To suggest that it's all done on the same typewriter is ridiculous. You know, if there were 100 documents
all done
and you
the
had
same
99...
way is ridiculous, you know. Well, why would everything be done exactly the same way on every document? That's not human nature.
Well, it wouldn't. It's just like somebody else said, oh, the documents are fraud because the date is 18 November, comma, 1952. That comma violates the government style manual. Obviously, the documents are fraud. Well, if you go to the archives, you find I had one file folder had seven different date formats in it.
Right.
You know, it's one of those arguments that sounds good, but isn't good. And there are a whole
bunch of these
arguments, and anybody can go to my website, www.stantonfriedman.com, and I have a review of a negative book about Majestic 12, and none of his criticisms stand up. Do your homework is my advice to people. If you're going to give me a hard time, get some facts in hand before putting computer in gear, you know. So my conclusion was that three documents are genuine. There's over 100 that are phony, and I pointed out why a bunch of them were, the things that were wrong with those documents. I suspect they had intelligence agents who were going to school or something. Hey, guys, come up with another one, will you? We need more. Flood the market.
Well, that's disinformation. I mean, whenever they want you to not pay attention to something over here, they put out something over there, and that's what disinformation is.
Yeah, and I'm sure there are people saying, oh, the U.S. government wouldn't do that. Would they? Of course they would.
I think it's standard practice.
During World War II, as a matter of fact. We went through great effort, we and the British, to convince Hitler that the upcoming European invasion would take place near Calais, France. And we even put stuff, semi-innocent papers, in the coat of a dead guy, which implied, if you looked at it carefully, they dropped them off in near Spain, and they knew the Spanish were sharing their stuff with Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And they dropped it off, and it misled people. And it was very important disinformation, incidentally, because Hitler withheld the support troops, reinforcements, The general said, send in the troops because they're invading at Normandy. Ah, says Hitler, they're really going to
I know better.
Palace. And by the time they did get around to sending in the troops, we had the troops, we had our feet on the ground and our guys in charge.
Right.
So I say that because some people are very naive. We wouldn't do that. Of course we would, and we did do it, you know.
Yeah.
We fooled the Germans. We fooled the Japanese. We sent phony messages. Disinformation is the word. But what I'm saying is it's not surprising. All's fair in love and war, you know.
Well, the other thing that I can't fathom is why somebody would have leaked fake documents. I mean, you know, it doesn't make sense to me. What group would want to leak the fake documents on this issue? I mean, the
bunkers. You mean what non-government group or what government group?
Well, either. I mean, what group would?
Well,
I mean,
you can understand wanting to do it. When good stuff gets out, if we put out enough bad stuff, hopefully people will ignore it. Oh, everybody knows those documents are phony. I've had people tell me that. And you might try to fool the Russians, and people have it. The original documents were fake, hoping that they would fool the Russians into thinking that we had alien technology when we really didn't, and, you know, on and on. I have to decide on the facts with regard to each document with the information that's given. As a matter of fact, I have a whole list of how did a faker know, because there's a whole bunch of little trivial things in the document. For example, it says that the research was begun on Roswell by General Twining and Dr. Bush on 7 July 1947. Now, I was able to prove that was the day that, because I got his flight log, that General Twining went from Wright Field to New Mexico.
Right.
There's a Truman Forrestal memo, and I was able to prove by contacting the library and then asking if they told anybody else this, that the date of that, which was 24 September 1947, was the only day in a two-month period when Truman and Vannevar Bush, whose name is in the document, and Secretary Forrest all met together, all three of them. You know, how did somebody know that? And
well, they wouldn't
there's
have.
A memo from... well, he was a general, had been a general. Robert Cutler was sort of Ike's national security advisor, had a slightly different title. It's an important memo, but it doesn't have a signature on it. And it doesn't even have /S/, which means original signed by. Well, we found out long after we got the documents that Bobby Cutler was in Europe at the time. If there had been a signature...
It would,
have to have been a phony document.
Right,
you know,
right.
So there's a whole long list of these things. And so I have to go where the data takes me. Now, remember, murders get committed even if we don't know why. You say, well, why would he do that? I don't know why. That isn't the question. The question is, did he do it? You know?
Right.
So it's a forensic trail, if you will. But it was intriguing to me. And also, there were things not only about Menzel, but there was another name on there, a General Robert Montague, who was a member of this group. And we found out by looking at the meetings that Truman had with people during this time frame, July 1947, that Montague was introduced to Truman by Leslie Groves, who was head of the Manhattan Project, the engineer and so forth. And... that was interesting, and I managed to locate Montague's son. I talked to family members of all of the 13 are named, the original 12 plus one more, and except for one, a guy named Smith. It was hard to find anybody.
Right.
There were too many Smiths, you know. Anyway, I found Montague's son, and he pointed out to me that, well, you know, Montague was a classmate of General Twining at West Point. That was interesting to know because that was a strong bond. People may not realize it, but if you were a classmate of somebody at Annapolis, the Naval Academy, or West Point.
Right.
Army Military Academy. This is a lifelong bond. Members of a class were, they were a tight-knit group. And he also explained to me the reason Dad would have been on that team was that he had plenty of troops. He was a commander at Fort Bliss, which is at the south end of southeastern end of New Mexico. And so there's all kinds of trivia, if you will. And what bothers me is the guys who do the complaining, as far as I know, none of them have been to the Harvard archives to look at the Menzel papers, even though they insist that Menzel couldn't have been part of such a thing. You can't lead a double life.
Oh, yeah, really?
Well, I got some of them
to ludicrous.
Acknowledge that there were three English spies, Russian spies, who worked in MI5 in England, Burgess, Philby, and McLean.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's where you got to be careful. You're working for British intelligence, and you're spying for Russia. And they did it for years. Don't tell me
they did.
Can't lead double lives. You know.
That's what the intelligence business is all about. In many cases, I mean,
to deceive.
That's right, to deceive, and it would be perfect. I mean, I think having Dr. Donald Menzel on that list proves that it is most likely accurate and a true representation of the committee, because you would expect somebody to have, you know, become a debunker off of this committee.
Well, he's the only one of the group that had written science fiction. He wrote under another name, but I found it out anyway. So the perfect guy, hey, Don, we got to do stuff to keep people away from this. So
right.
Do the debunking, will you? You know, and one of his books was translated into Russian early on and kept a lot of them from thinking there was anything to this phenomenon.
And that was very important that Russia not, in this time frame anyway, Russia not think that we had that technology. That's very true.
Well, I also found out that he did summer work at a very high pay for the time for an organization in Minnesota that was keeping on with code breaking and stuff like that. And the head of the company was his wartime commander doing this kind of work. So I found somebody who was at a celebration of the 50th anniversary of this company, something like that. And he was talking to somebody who knew Menzel, who was a consultant for this company. So I talked to this guy, and I was very careful in how I asked the questions. Yes, he knew him, and, was he there every summer, or, you know, did he stay all summer long? And, usually he was there because, after all, he wasn't teaching in the summer. And, but my buddy who told me about this had said, he said that there was a time when he left in a hurry one summer. So I asked him about that. I said, yeah, you know, it was kind of funny. I was a young man, and, all of a sudden, Don has to leave, and I presume it was something classified because he wasn't broadcasting. Why? And I said, do you have any idea when that was? Just bit my tongue. You know, I wanted to say, was it in 1947?
Yeah, was it?
But I knew that would foul things up.
Leading question.
And then I'm putting words in his mouth.
That's right.
And so I waited. He said, let me see now. I think that was 1947 because of something or other, which didn't mean anything to me. But so I didn't put words in his mouth, but 47 was the time I was looking for.
Right.
So it was a hunting game, and I really enjoyed it. I didn't enjoy the attacks from people who didn't know what they were talking about because, you know, it just muddies the waters. You got to waste your time. Another attack. This is from a former military guy, was that in the memo, it says the briefing officer was Admiral Roscoe Hillencoder. He was the director of Central Intelligence in 47. And the kicker was he wasn't an admiral. He was only a rear admiral. He would never call himself an admiral. So obviously that's the most important reason for saying the document is a fraud. Well, when I was at the, I mean, that sounds good until you realize that it was baloney. Because when I was at the Eisenhower Library, I ran across, I talked to archivists, and I got to see a bunch of memcons, memos of conversation by a general, no less, General Goodpaster, And he would sit in on Ike's meeting with various and sundry people and keep a record of who agreed to do what, when, you know, that sort of thing. And they were often a mixture of civilians and military guys. And so I got a bunch of these memorandums of conversation, and at the beginning he would list all the attendees. And he didn't say Rear Admiral or Brigadier General. He said General so-and-so, Admiral so-and-so, even calling himself General Goodpaster. He signed it Brigadier General Goodpaster.
Right. Well, I could have
and
told
so
you
I
that
asked
from
the
being in the military.
That's
standard.
The generic
in the military.
Ranks, and they tell me.
Yeah, it's generic
practice.
Rank. You don't. Yeah, exactly.
You can answer the phone, Colonel Jones. You signed a memo, Lieutenant Colonel. But and Ike does this in his book, Mandate for Change. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, at the Eisenhower Library, they got a book listing all kinds of military people and what their actual ranks were. I mean, I recognize some of them, but not many. And so you could look and find that there were, on these MEMCONs, for example, there were loads of guys who were not four stars, but who were called general or admiral. And the people at the Eisenhower Library.
You're called general if you just
have
one star. What else would you call them? I mean, that's the thing.
Well, Brigadier General, of course.
No, you don't hear that in the military, though. I mean, it's written.
Well, you and I know that,
people
but the debunkers don't.
Well, the debunkers really ought to get a life.
Well, that's right. And what bothers me is they start with a conclusion, and they won't open-mindedly look at the evidence and say, well, does that make any sense? Or, you know, how did he know that? And my book, Top Secret Magic, incidentally, I have to tell you, I'm very proud of the fact that movie rights have been purchased, optioned, I guess is the word, for my book, Top Secret Magic, the book we've just been talking about, and my life story to go with that, and Don Schmidt's book, Witness to Roswell, and a screenplay has already been written for a movie. And it's
wonderful.
Had good reviews from some top names in Hollywood. You know, it'd be a combination of dynamic movies, sort of like JFK or All the President's Men.
Mm-hmm.
And Richard Dreyfuss would play me, I say. That's not an official
No, that's
thing.
Wonderful.
I mean, all
because,
they're doing
you know,
now is looking for money. This
yeah,
is
the debunkers, and I suspect the secret government behind all of this would have us believe that anybody who believes in UFOs is stupid and backwoods and just, you know, unable to even
think. Some kind of a nut.
Exactly, some kind of a nut. And that's, I mean, in your book, Flying Saucers and Science, you actually go into great detail about the more educated one is, the more likely they are to believe in UFOs.
Yeah,
which is very
but also the most stupid comments will come from those more educated people, too. The arrogance gets in the way, in other words.
Well, and the other thing, I love in your book when you said that there's a group of journalists and scientists who take the position that if there was anything to know, I would have known it.
Yeah. Yeah, and that applies to a lot of other things besides UFOs, you understand.
It does, yeah.
Well, I call it the David Susskind syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
He used to have a television talk show many years ago when I was on it. I had to supply him with all kinds of materials and get him in contact with other people and so forth and so on. And they flew me to New York from California, and between takes, and there was no audience, he says to me, you know, I read the New York Times. There's nothing in there that says these things are real. And so the syndrome is I'm somebody who feels it's very important to keep up with the important stuff that's going on in the world, the significant stuff. If aliens were visiting Earth, that would be a big story. I readily acknowledge that. But if that were true, I would know about it, and I don't.
Right.
So it must not be true. I'm not going to waste my time working on something that's obvious nonsense. And I find this syndrome fairly often. You know, when you start pressing to find out what homework they had done, you find they haven't. And you may have noticed there was another chapter about SETI, the cult of SETI,
right.
S-E-T-I, search for extraterrestrial intelligence? No, silly effort to investigate, I call it. And these guys claim that they're looking for extraterrestrial intelligence, but they absolutely refuse to look at the UFO evidence. They're going to listen for signals because they know aliens are going to send signals to us, and they will pick them up, and it'll be one of the great moments in man's history when we finally make contact. And Dr. Jill Tarter said that there could be somebody as close as 1,000 light years. We make contact, they will help us solve our problems. Now, how you do that,
not
I don't
necessarily.
Know. You know, hi out there, we got a problem, can you help us? They pick that message up in 1,000 years, and
that's right.
1,000 years later you get their
we're
answer.
Like the
hey,
cosmic
what can
beggar.
We do for you? So, you know, it's really strange. And for those, look, I'm very much impressed with the Kepler satellite, for example, which is now saying, the people who run it are saying, it looks as though in our galaxy alone, there might be 100 billion planets. 100 billion.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Frank Drake of the SETI Society, if you will, said just a few years ago that there could be as many as 8,000 planets in our galaxy which could be sending messages. So we've jumped from 8,000 to 100 billion.
Mm-hmm.
And that's rather a large difference. And the kicker here, we're talking on radio. We've had long-distance radio transmission since Marconi about 1900, so 112 years ago, let's say. Now, why would anybody send us signals appropriate for reception by old technology like that? Surely somebody's been at it longer than we have. As I mentioned, Zeta Reticuli is a billion years older than the sun. If they're only 500 years more advanced than we are, we're not going to be able to understand their signals or pick them up
right.
using our old equipment. I mean, that's ridiculous. So I don't understand these guys, but they have nice jobs and let them go at it and listen away. But anybody who expects that's how we're going to find out about extraterrestrial intelligence is kidding themselves. We learn about them, about eyewitness testimony here, not out there.
Yeah. And it's also important to understand why or when the UFO activity clusters. Like I think you pointed out that it clusters when we start testing nuclear weapons. So that makes sense that, you know, we get their attention because we're doing something different, and they send observers to find out what it is.
Well, the kicker, let me give an example. The first H-bomb, 1952, the fireball was 3 miles wide. It released the energy of 10 million tons of TNT. Now, 10 years before, a big bomb released the energy of 10 tons of TNT.
Right.
So the idiots on Earth, and I use that term, people say, why are you calling us idiots? Because in World War II, we killed 50 million of our own kind. We destroyed 1,700 cities. We killed people with nuclear weapons. You know, we've exploded another 2,000 weapons, fortunately, nuclear weapons, none of them on people. But if you were an alien, you wouldn't want us out there.
No.
Because we're nasty, a primitive society whose major activity is obviously tribal warfare. Hasn't changed much
That's
since
right.
that time either. You know, the military on this planet this year will spend $1 trillion, while several thousand children will die every single day of preventable disease or starvation.
Right.
There's something wrong with that picture.
There is. And the
and
other
I've asked a lot
point.
Of people, if you were an alien, would you want Earthlings out there? And they'd say no.
And the other point I wanted to emphasize is that the Air Force gave orders to shoot UFOs down if they didn't land when ordered to. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. It's discussed in great detail in Frank Fischino's excellent book, Shoot Them Down. I wrote the foreword for it.
Right.
It's
and
one
I
of the
think
books
that...
listed on my website, www.stantonfriedman.com. And Frank did a great job.
And I'm not sure of this, but maybe you can elaborate for our audience. I think the Roswell incident and some of the Texas incident may have been a radar type thing that interfered with the flight of the UFO. Is there a theory to that effect?
Well, I allow room for that partly because I know from stuff that was published at the time that in early July 1947 there was a launch of a missile, a V-2 rocket, planned, and at those days they used only vacuum tube radar,
mm-hmm.
no transistors or solid state devices. So you left the systems on, so you wouldn't have to warm up.
Right. Yeah, that's true.
Up. So we know that there was a beam on. Now this was not going around in circles; it was a tracking beam.
Mm-hmm.
So it was pointed in one direction. And, I mean, what are you going to do? You're going to cook a few birds. It's not going to hurt anybody.
Right.
But if you happen to be an innocent pair of flying saucers going by and you ran into this beam, which you wouldn't have anybody else on the planet, it might have temporarily discombobulated your propulsion system, your guidance system.
Right. You
crashed. Caused two to collide. Who knows what? Not intentionally.
Yeah.
But in the wrong place at the wrong time, you know. I didn't know there was glass on the highway when I drove by.
Right. No, I think that that is when I was reading. I was reading some of the books that I studied, and I was, of course, at the lectures at the Truth Convention, and it just seemed to me that it made sense that something we did unintentionally might have caused the crash, because
sure.
after all, there aren't a huge number of crafts that have crashed before this period, and
no.
the radar was present in more than one of the crash sites. The radar was there, so that's a theory
yes.
anyway.
Yeah, and that makes sense is the point. And you know, I get people who think I had an English astronomer say, "Well, why would anybody go to New Mexico? There's nothing there but sand." Of course, he'd never been there, wasn't aware that two of the three nuclear weapons labs are in New Mexico.
Yeah, really?
was the biggest employer in the state, that Roswell was the home of the 509th, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. yeah.
You know,
well,
nothing like opening your mouth without doing your homework first.
Right, exactly. Well, we can assume that, you know, the majority of the evidence that you've carefully looked at and examined and given reasons for which it should be considered authentic, is that we actually have been, our government has been engaged in this observation of UFOs
yes.
at least since 1947. Is that correct?
Yes, yes. Now, there may have been stuff that they picked up before that, but we were very busy with the war.
Mm-hmm.
There were Foo Fighters during World War II that after the war, the Germans and the American pilots got together. And we thought that was you guys. Oh, we thought they were
right,
yours.
Yeah.
You know, these
yeah, that's true.
Strange lights that circled around. And
yeah.
It would, you know, one of the things that tells you something about Earth is if you fly around a lot, you'll see that there are loads of different radar systems, different frequencies,
mm-hmm.
different techniques, et cetera. Obviously, we're monitoring the skies because we are worried about somebody else giving us a hard time.
Right, right. Well, I wanted to mention that I'll be interviewing, let's see, captured the Betty and Barney Hill UFO experience. I'll be interviewing Kathleen Martin.
Good show.
3rd of March. I wanted to mention that because you're the co-author of that book, I believe. Isn't that right?
Yes, she did most of the work. We got to give her credit.
Okay.
It was her aunt, after all, who was Betty Hill.
Right, right. She's the niece. And I think we've only just really touched a few areas of the UFO question. I'd like to invite you back to...
Sure.
Perhaps do another book. You can choose whichever one you think would be best. And I'd like to continue this discussion because really it's
okay.
fascinating. It's really a study in what you know. I think our next place in history is to undergo disclosure and come clean with what has happened and why it's happened. And I think that's our next great step in evolution,
I think you're probably
is disclosure.
Right. Let's remember that Copernicus's book. Now, Copernicus said the Earth is not the center of the universe; the Sun is.
Mm-hmm.
The book was banned for 300 years by the Church.
Right, right.
We're now at a time where we have to say, "Sorry, the Sun isn't the middle of the universe either." And
right.
We Earthlings are not at the top of the heap, much as that distresses some people.
Not at all. That's so true. Well, would you like to give your website one more time? Because you have a number of books that they can find on the website.
It's www.stantonfriedman, F-R-I-E-D-M-A-N, .com. And it lists not only books, it's got a number of articles, including things like Government UFO Lies. That's a long article because there are a lot of lies.
Long article.
Yeah.
Well, that's
and,
great.
There's a lot of other tidbits on there, and there's some websites. And, incidentally, MUFON's address is given on there, the Mutual UFO Network, and there's mm-hmm. big conference this year is across the river from Cincinnati in early August. I'll be in mm-hmm. Roswell. First weekend in July. There's still plenty going on. And, you know, I shot somebody this morning who was visiting me, wanted to buy a book, and how come there aren't any sightings anymore, he says. And I said, well, MUFON got 600 reports last month, and 600 the month before, and 700 the month before that.
Right.
What?
You know, plenty of.
Yeah,
and I want to point out that the foreword to Flying Saucers and Science, one of the forewords is by Dr. Edgar Mitchell, who was the sixth man to walk on the moon and the founder of noetic science. So, you know, at least some people who have been in the high level in NASA do believe that there are UFOs.
Right. Right on.
So, right on. Yes.
Thanks.
Well, thank
Thanks
you so,
so much
for joining us today.
It's a pleasure.
I appreciate it.
And we'll
have you back with one of your other books and continue this discussion.
Okay.
Next week?
Thanks
great.
So
thanks a lot, Stan. I appreciate it. Next week on Temple of Health Radio Show, we will be talking with Helen Adrian on Fertile Ground, Healing Infertility. And then we have Marie Jones back on the 11th, Destiny versus Choice, the Scientific and Spiritual Evidence Behind Fate and Free Will. We will be talking about Bio-Intrinsic Energy with Ed Edwards on the 18th. And on the 25th, Dr. Richard Presser, the 2012 Countdown. Temple of Health is a show that tries to put everything together, the 2012, the Ascension, the UFO questions, and other questions about where we're going. Noetic Science, which is in February, will be on February 16th, a Thursday, at 7:15 in the Georgetown Square office. Richard Sachs is the producer of Frequency of Genius. These are some of the top minds in these fields talking about what we were just talking about, revolutionary thinking and where we're going as a race. This is Dr. Susan Kalb with Temple of Health Radio Show. Join us next week.